Well, tonight, a series of special reports with our investigative reporter, Linda Moulton Howe. Stories of high strangeness and great mysteries as well. When we come back in a moment, Linda will talk with us about the mysterious situations happening near Florida. Very weird. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Of course, she is an Emmy Award-winning television producer, investigative reporter, author. Her website, earthfiles.com. She's a regular contributor here of Coast to Coast with her amazing stories and research. And here is Linda Moulton Howe. Hey, Linda, you ready for Thanksgiving?
Well, I hope so. It has been just so beautiful here. I feel sorry for the weather in some parts of the country because I know that makes travel really rough.
Yeah, they're getting blasted away. Now, do you cook the turkey or do you go someplace else? What do you do?
My brother and friends are the best cooks in the world. I bring the champagne and they do the cooking.
That's perfect.
Yes, it is. And one of the subjects we're going to talk about are all of the strange, mysterious aerial phenomena in southern Florida, especially in the Naples region, even as far north as Fort Myers and then down to San Marco Island. It's kind of like a 40-mile, I guess you'd call it kind of an arc of beach there.
Yeah.
But this year of 2010, I had no idea how much was happening until after last month's coast, a friend of mine who lives in Naples sent me a local newspaper article. And it was from the Marco Eagle Sunday edition. And it was an article called Starry Nights, Unexplained Sights by Tom Williams. He's an author of adventure novels. One is called Lost and Found, and he lives in that area. Mm-hmm. And he had interviewed Morgan Beale, who is the Florida State Section Director for MUFON. And lo and behold, since January of this year, MUFON and local police and fire authorities have received a lot of calls from Naples, from the Isles of Capri, and Marco Island about highly strange aerial lights that spin and form geometric patterns that keep changing, and even one very large object of unknown origin that has been compared to a gyroscope because it has both horizontal and vertical bands of lights that spin around and around a central bright glowing center. And there was one local fisherman, he wants to remain anonymous, and he reported seeing this large bright aerial gyroscope right above his boat. And then Tom Williams quoted him as saying, and here is a quote, "A very distinctive black void appeared within the center of the glowing white light. As the black opening began to grow larger than the surrounding light, the fisherman thought a door or a portal was opening," close quote. The fisherman sped away in his boat, but he could see this bright orb descending into what would be the thick mangroves on Johnson Island. And it turns out that it is Johnson Bay and Johnson Island that have seemed to be the main focus of the unidentified light phenomena this year. And some explorers have even found half a dozen circular bare spots in the mangroves where nothing grows. One of the residents sent me an aerial image, which is at earthfiles.com right now, of one of these strange, this is at about an 18-foot diameter circle in the mangroves where nothing is growing. Well, one of the closest encounters with the aerial gyroscope occurred on May 26th near the Isles of Capri, not far from Johnson Bay. Ann Hall is a retired school administrator and a columnist for the Marcos Island Sun-Times. She was with her husband, Eddie, and neighbors, Ginny and Chuck Walton, from around 10 p.m. to 11:15 p.m., so at least an hour. The night of May 26, all four watched with cameras and binoculars as this large orb with colored light spinning horizontally while white light spun vertically hovered over the bay near their homes. Ann Hall became frustrated with trying to get her camera to work and decided to sketch what she was seeing through binoculars right then and there. And you can see that fascinating sketch at my news website, earthfiles.com, and many of colored photos of these persistent strange lights that I have been gathering from various people. Now, here is Anne Hall to tell what she has seen in the Isles of Capri, Florida.
Okay, here we go.
And it was this gigantic white ball of light, and it was absolutely breathtaking to look at. I mean, it was just beautiful. It was like the most vivid ball of light, Christmas ornament, or whatever you want to call it, that I've ever seen in my life. And it left you just feeling like you couldn't explain what you were looking at, and you couldn't take your eyes off of it, but it was too bright to stare at it.
And in your drawing, you've got colors, and what kind of size do you think this is?
The lights ran vertically as well as horizontally, and it seemed as if the colored lights ran horizontally around a bright white globe-like object, but you could put your hand in it if you'd been close to it. It's the way you felt, because you could see into it. And what I saw was inside of it, at sometimes it looked like a black hole, and other times it looked like a great big piece of aluminum or something of some sort. I mean, it was so reflective. And then through the binoculars, we could see it had these little jagged things coming off the top and the bottom.
They were white or clear or?
They were more white. And this thing, it gave off like a pulsating yellow and white light. But it was absolutely, totally silent. And anything around here that we see coming in from a half a mile away, you can hear. Because the voices of people coming in on boats and noises coming in reflect on the water. And we could hear nothing, absolutely nothing. It was like a huge gyroscope is the way it looked.
All this stuff was spinning around some kind of a center sphere.
Right, around some kind of a center. And then describing where it was in relationship to us, I would say it would be about not even a block down the street, and then straight up over the water, which would have been facing a little bit northwest. We kept looking at the thing, and it would go out, like it just disappear, and then it would come back. It would slip up, and then it would slip down, and it would dead out to the right. In fact, Eddie, my husband, one time ran to the backyard to see if it was going in that direction. It looked like it went to the right and disappeared, and he ran to the backyard, and it wasn't there, and then all of a sudden, we saw it just, like, come back up again, just out of nowhere.
Size?
Maybe 18 or 20 feet tall and across, so a diameter of something that was that size, more like 20 by 20. It had just a slight indentation on the top and on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
It was different from what we had seen, like, back in March, but similar in many ways.
So we're talking about a May 26th event in which there are four eyewitnesses, and you are on the Isles of Capri near your home.
Right. Actually, there were more because a lady drove down the street and asked what we were doing because my husband had lit citronella candles in the driveway because you may have mosquitoes at night. And she stopped and opened her door, and she said, I know you all are not looking at the moon. And we said, no, we're not. And she said, I know what you're looking at. I've been looking at it for the last two or three years off and on. And she lives down the street. But so many people, we found out, had seen this thing or these things but not reported anything what they had seen. So
how long did this May 26th object stay not far from your house?
Well, it's interesting because immediately we were watching it a little after 9, 9:15 by the time we set up the cameras. It's like time slipped by. We had no idea that the time had gotten so late, and we couldn't believe that it just went out as if you had just snuffed it out like a candle.
And this time it didn't come back.
And it did not come back, no.
In March, which would be 2 months before, what happened?
In March, it was on March the 27th. I remember it vividly because I came down and we had, my husband and I, we are in a two-story house and our bedroom is downstairs, but it's an interesting house. You have to go outdoors to get downstairs. It's a screen area outside, a pool, and so you go out of the upstairs to come down. So we watched television upstairs and at 10 o'clock we turned the TV off and started down and it was pouring cats and dogs. Raining, and here we are having to go out to come down. So we stopped at the top of the steps under the porch overhang, and we were just watching the rain when all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this big, humongous white globe-like ball of light just dropped down out of the sky and hovered. And this one was even closer than the other one. And it hovered. The first night it had been raining, and we had gusts of wind up to 45 miles an hour, and the object didn't budge. There was no sound. There was no noise. It was about 150 feet over Johnson's Bay, which is towards the back of our house. And then the next night, we still had the weather conditions similar, although the rains had stopped and the winds were still hard, but not much more than 20-mile-an-hour winds. We watched for about 20 minutes, and then it just kind of jotted off to the right, did this little gyration of movement, and it dipped down, and it looked like it was just going to go down into the water, and it just disappeared. Then the third night, the weather had cleared, and the moon was beautiful. It was coming up in the east, and then this object also appeared about the same time again that night. So it was coming in sometime after 10, and it would stay 20, 30 minutes and just hover and do some kind of little crazy motion movements. Sometimes it would back up. Sometimes it would come forward just slightly. One time it looked like it shot up, and the other time it looked like it just shot down, and then it would come back.
When it shot down, was it shooting straight down into water?
It looked like it. Like it just went straight down into the water out of nowhere. But the strange thing about the whole thing is the next morning I got a call from a fire station. There is a grove of mangroves between us, so we can't actually see the station from our house. But we had just gotten a webcam for our fire station, a weather camera. And I run just a voluntary email service where I notify everybody on the island when we have meetings or if there's a hurricane warning or whatever. The chief will give me the information, then I'll get it out to our people. And the next morning, the chief called me. He said, "Ann, did you see anything strange last night?" And I said, "Yeah, we did. Did you see it?" And he says, "Yeah, and a lot of our fire crew saw it, and so did some of the people in the restaurant that are on the other side of the fire station." And he said, "I looked on our webcam because we had it facing in that direction, and it picked up something really weird. It definitely was a humongous, white, bright, breathtaking object. There was nothing that we knew of that could fly like that and just hover and not move and not make a sound and then do this little dart motion to the right, down, then go straight down, then come straight up, disappear. There was nothing that could do that kind of thing that we knew of."
Was it the same 20 by 20 feet size as the gyroscope in May?
To me, it seemed slightly smaller.
And how many people saw the March object?
Many. One of the neighbors has a restaurant that's a little further down from the fire station, and he runs little sunset cruises. He said that he was taking the boat home one of those nights, and he said that this thing came down over his boat and just hovered, and it scared the living daylights out of him. What he had seen are these huge places. I mean, one he described was as large as our church across the street, maybe be 150 by 130.
And these are circles in the mangroves where no mangroves or anything grows, but they are big circles.
That's right. And he said that the sand was so white, it was glass-like. One of the circles that he described when he pointed where it was is just about in the same vicinity that Eddie and I saw that first one in March. But the strange thing, when you see something that large, you can't visualize it going down into the waters here because they're not that deep. The water in the middle of where this would be maybe at the most 16, 18 feet deep.
Wow.
You know, 20 feet deep. And in the mangroves, of course, they're taller, but the only really deep water we have is in the river. And, of course, people have seen it in the river, too, right over the river. So we've had a lot of different sightings, and most of them are similar in that they are the globe-shaped one, although some of the people have also seen some that were shaped more like a V with lights.
Now, since May of 2010, and we're speaking in the middle of November, have there been any other reports by people in the Isles of Capri about any similar glowing objects or this big gyroscopic object?
Absolutely. On the night of July the 8th, this thing appeared again, and this time it was smaller. My son and daughter-in-law set up a video camera and their digital camera, and they proceeded to take movies and still shots. And it was moving towards us and backing up And sometimes it would turn sideways, and it looked almost like a torpedo shape. And so when it would turn forward towards us, it had a round shape. But then when it turned on a side view, you could see like a bar in the middle between it, and it almost looked like there were two balls hooked together.
Like a dumbbell.
Yeah, like a barbell type thing.
And what color was that?
It was a red and yellow glow, like white when it was facing you. And then when it turned sideways, you would see red and yellow glowing spiral thing in the middle of it that was like a handle if you were hooking two things together, like a barbell, like the part that you hold on to with your hand.
And would one side of the barbell be red and one side be yellow?
I couldn't tell whether it was just spinning and we were seeing the colors that way. It was actually scary because it kept coming towards, like it was coming towards you, and then the light went out. But the strangest thing about that whole night is while they're videotaping and taking still pictures, the thing came towards us and then it went out. And when it went out, both of their cameras went dead at the same time. I ran in to see if we could find another battery to put in the camera. In the meantime, when I came back, she was yelling, "It's back," and our cameras are back on. And when we looked back at the video footage of what she had gotten,
right,
it never showed the camera going off ever. But it appeared to have lost all its power at the same time that our son was holding the digital camera and his went out.
You have an image that is on the videotape during the time that you guys thought it was not functioning?
Yes, we did. And George, I have some of the video and frames from the video at earthfiles.com so people can see exactly what was happening. And I learned just recently, and in fact, did another interview this afternoon with the Naples fire chief, that is Steve McInerney, and learned about dramatic events that took place on September 14th, not very long ago. It was between 8:30 that 911 calls started going into the fire chief and the police, and he took off for the Naples Pier. There were 50 or 60 people already there with cameras, and out, I mean, he didn't think it was more than a couple, maybe 2 miles, 3 miles. There were lights, and you can see at Earth Files, because I've tried to put them in kind of a sequential, taking samples from a whole bunch of videos that he has shared with me and giving examples of what happened over an hour of time between 8:30 and 9:45 p.m. on September 14th. And as you look at the photos, you see that there are like three yellow spheres, and then there are four. Then they turn into an arc. Then they turn into a V. Then they turn into what Chief McInerney described as looking like a Ferris wheel from the side, and the lights had this curve, and they kept moving, and they had the appearance of each spinning. And then one of the lights drops away, there are fewer and fewer lights, and then suddenly two larger lights pop into screen, and looking on the video, they hold their position while they move horizontally, these two large orange objects. Never lose the distance between each other. It is as if they are locked by something. And you can see those dumbbells. And all of this took place with the fire chief and a couple of policemen and all these people watching. And then he told me that it was on the 9th of November. So this month, not very long ago.
Not at all.
No. That they had the police got a 911 call, and it was a woman in one of the high-rise condominiums with a good telescope, and she said she was watching this object and that it was spinning, and the police went to her condominium, looked through her telescope, talked with Chief McInerney, and he showed them Ann Hall's illustration that is at Earth Files, and the policeman said, "That's what we saw through the telescope."
That's a great story. Linda's got much more when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest tonight, our investigative reporter, Linda Moulton Howe, and here's some of the stories ahead with Linda. Dead and dying coral south of the BP Gulf oil disaster. ICBM heavy concrete silo covers moved aside by glowing disks. A Texas nurse has a close encounter with something bizarre, something non-human. More with Linda when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, your next story still takes you around the Florida area, doesn't it?
Well, the Gulf. And the when you think back to April 20th, and when all of us saw those headlines and the terrible video on television when the BP Deepwater Horizon, that drill rig, exploded, 11 men working on the platform died, 17 others were injured. And then over the next 3 months, it was just the endless dripping news about some 53,000 barrels of crude oil per day possibly gushed. And it was uncontrollable until the Gulf of Mexico's Macondo well that had blown out a mile down in the Gulf finally got a cap on it on July 15th. And by then, nearly 5 million barrels, combined with that controversial chemical dispersant called Corexit, had soiled the Gulf waters and covered birds and marine life with the slimy goo and all of those terrible video pictures that we saw night after night, day after day. Well, in early August, the federal report tried to paint an optimistic picture by saying nearly 70% of the oil spill had already disappeared, either because of the dispersant or natural disintegration. And that government spin was blasted by scientists who argued that no one knew how many creatures, including the corals, had been killed on the Gulf Sea floor. And when that oil disaster happened, there was one scientist who was already in his fourth year of a NOAA-funded research project to examine deep water coral communities of them in the Gulf of Mexico. He is Charles R. Fisher, PhD, professor of biology at Penn State University's Eberly College of Science and Biology, and that is in University Park, Pennsylvania. He was scheduled to dive with NOAA's sophisticated deepwater robot explorer called Jason on October 14th to November 4th. During the first days of their cruise north of the Macondo well site, they found healthy coral communities and marine life. But in the last week of their exploration, the scientists were southwest of the oil disaster. And around 7 miles out, they found at least 90% of the coral was dead or dying. In his entire marine science career that has included more than 50 dives, Dr. Fisher told me he has never before seen such extensive coral community death. Here now is Professor Charles Fisher from Penn State University.
About 6 hours into the dive, we came across a community of corals, a site with a number of different coral colonies on it. And virtually every one of those coral colonies was showing some sign of a recent impact. Many of them were dead, and many others were in the process of dying. Parts of the colony were dead, parts were covered with the brown material, and other parts were still alive.
Now, is some of the brown material the mucus that coral emits trying to protect itself in a defensive mode, or was most of it gunk from all of this oil that had settled down over the coral?
Well, that's a very good question, and one we don't really know the answer to yet. We sampled it, and we're doing analyses on it. Certainly, stressed corals produce a lot of mucus, and dying corals get pretty sticky. And on the bottom of the ocean, in an environment like the Gulf of Mexico, anything with a lot of mucus and a lot of sticky is going to get gunk attaching to it. So my best guess is that at least a portion of that, and maybe all of it, is something that attached to the corals more recently. And it could very well be gunk of various kinds, resuspended sediment, particles that are in the water that are sticking to this sticky, gooey, and dying surface.
Now, of all of this coral area where you saw so much damage, what is your estimate of how much of the coral is actually dead?
My estimate is that about 90% of the coral colonies in this community were either dead or dying when we were there last week. But we have never, in my years of work in the Deep Gulf, encountered a community of corals that were dying.
Until now.
Until now. I've seen dead corals, I've seen live corals, but I've never seen a community that was dying.
And the implication is that the BP oil disaster is directly related to a swath southwest of the Makonda well, where not only is 90% of the coral community that you've investigated dead or dying, but that when you go back to look further southwest, you might find even more devastation.
I think that the location of this find, the depth, the direction, and the timing are all very strong circumstantial evidence that it's tied. I think it would be a heck of a coincidence if these were isolated events. As to what else we'll find, we're going to need to go take a look.
I think it was only around the time that the Makonda well was finally closed off. And I think that there were scientists who were saying that it didn't make sense that all of that oil and the dispersant that went into the Gulf for so long would just have disappeared.
You know, we didn't find direct evidence of oil on the bottom at that site. Now, we found circumstantial evidence that something had happened there that had killed the biology that's there now. Your question about oil disappearing and dispersant disappearing, I think that is, you know, a quote that was a little bit exaggerated. I don't think any intelligent person thought it just disappeared. The question is how much of it had been metabolized and is no longer present. Certainly, there was a lot of it in the deep sea. It did not disappear instantly, and it would have certainly impacted some animals in the deep sea. And the question we've got to grapple with is how far did it go? And how widespread was the impact? And that's what we're trying to address.
Which direction from the BP Makonda site?
This is to the southwest, and it's a likely direction to look because the models that NOAA oceanographers have put together and some of the data that people have collected suggest that a deep water plume of oil and dispersant that may have originated at this site most likely moved to the southwest. And it's no coincidence that that's the area we chose to make this dive in.
And that move would be because of the natural water currents around that area?
That's correct. That's what the water currents were doing at that time in that area. The water currents in the Gulf of Mexico are very complicated, but we did get enough data from that period of time to ground truth and produce some very nice models that suggest that's the direction we should be looking.
When will you arrive in December to do more investigation, and how long will you be there?
Yeah, so we're going to go back out on about December 7th. This is another expedition. Well, this expedition actually was funded after the disaster. It was funded by the National Science Foundation through a rapid proposal. And we've got about a week of time with the Alvin to go out and do some work there. And this, we really were lucky to get it because the Alvin's the, you know, nation's deep diving submarine, and it just happened to be available at the end of the year, and we're squeezing a weather window because the weather's going to get bad in the Gulf pretty soon, and it's not going to be a place you're going to want to take a submarine or an ROV. But we were able to squeeze this cruise into the schedule.
How much ground do you think you'll be able to cover?
On that expedition, we've got 6 dives planned. We will revisit this site. We'll revisit another site a little further away that has very similar species, which we're using as a control site. Then we've got 4 other dives that we can decide where they're going to go. So I hope to visit 4 other sites. We've also, in response to our recent discovery, the National Science Foundation has just given us another asset to use during this cruise. So during the night, when we're not diving with the submarine, we will be using an autonomous underwater vehicle to help us explore and tell us exactly where to dive. So we'll be doing 24-hour operations with a robot exploring for us in the night. and taking pictures, and in the day we'll be diving with a human-occupied submarine. So although we'll only be making six dives, they should be very, very profitable dives. The sites that we'll be diving on, they're different sizes and different shapes, but they're measured in kilometers as far as the area that we'll be trying to cover. The problem is in the deep ocean, the visibility is low. We can really, even with our lights, we can only see 20 or so feet. And the areas that the surface investigations tell us are interesting cover kilometers.
After the work in December for about a week, how long will it be before we learn what you all have found?
There's two answers to that question. And one is that we will endeavor to report our early results as quickly as possible after that cruise. I think we should be hitting port about December 15th, and we will try to release the results as quickly as we can do responsibly. But in addition to our visual observations, of course, there's analysis of the samples, like the brown gunk that we talked about earlier, and that takes time. And those results, again, will be reported to you as quickly as we have confidence in quality control.
What are the consequences of what happened in the spring of 2010 going to be for the Gulf marine life going forward?
It's a great question. And, you know, it's just one we don't know the answer to yet. The deep sea is a realm that is not only largely unexplored, but it's really not very well known. The animals that we find down there, although they've mostly been described, they've been given a name, we know very little about their life history, you know, how fast they grow, how long they live. So it's going to take a while before we'll know the answers to those questions. I think we're learning more every day. Things happen very slowly in the deep sea. It's the nature of that cold, removed environment, and it may take a long time before we really know what the full range of impacts are.
Jeez. What a sad story, Linda.
Well, it is, George, and the unanswered question is, did Dr. Fisher's expedition, October to November, actually find the smoking gun that everyone has wondered about, meaning that the crude oil and the dispersant has killed a lot of Gulf floor marine life, question mark. That has been the question hanging. And now they've got this area 7 miles southwest of the Macondo well site, where not only Dr. Fisher was surprised by the amount of the coral colony devastation, but Dr. Eric Cordes, he's a Temple University marine scientist. He was also on the expedition. And he says that they have identified about 25 other sites around this area and around the Macondo well site, where they think that there might be similar damage to what they found on this most recent expedition, and that when they go back December 15th, which is not very long from now, be leaving in a little bit less than a month, they're going to head back to those areas. And one of the severely damaged corals, it's called a Gorgonian. And Professor Cordes says that in his marine science work, he has never seen them survive the kind of tissue damage that he has seen in the Gorgonians so far. He thinks that they would have to start all over, that humans would have to come back into that Gulf area and literally replant the, because we're talking about animals when we're talking about corals. They are not plants. These are colonies of animal creatures, and they are essential to the Gulf, because this is, the corals are what provide sort of the homes and the hotels and the habitats for fish and other organisms like the snails and the crabs. And they make, this is a real problem if you have a large scale death of coral, because it will affect many species that have depended on the coral. It's like dominoes falling. If the coral dies, then what happens to the marine life that are dependent on those corals? And in fact, as sad as all of this is, 7 miles southwest of the Macondo well site in the Gulf, one of the recent stories coming from what's happening in our planet around the world in terms of coral deaths is coming out, new science research is coming out of the Indian Ocean and Southeast Asian region. Vast areas of coral reef have died due to excessive heat in 2010 alone. It is what researchers are now saying could be the world's worst coral losses ever on record in 2010, which makes the disaster in the Gulf even more important to find out, because corals are needed everywhere and they are dying everywhere. One of the scientists in the Indian Ocean said, quote, "So far, colonies and 50% of colonies from other species have died since the heat in May of 2010 in that region of the world. And the losses stretch from the Seychelles off Africa to the waters around Sri Lanka, Thailand, Indonesia. And now the question is, as we head into the winter and then come, which is now the Southern Hemisphere's summer, what's going to happen to the Great Barrier Reef as the summer warms? And they're expecting that there will be coral losses there. And the question is, how big, how much? And in our own Gulf of Mexico, that same question is what is going to be on the minds of Professor Fisher and Professor Cortez as they head out on December 15th back to areas where they hope to cover kilometers this time looking. And George, in January, what I'll be reporting is what have they found in terms of how large spread is the 90% death of coral communities.
And the sea life goes, so go human beings.
When you are on a planet that is this interconnected, and there are as many deaths and extinctions as are happening now, humans should take all of this as a gigantic alarm bell that we don't, life is not guaranteed here, not for humans or for anything else. And every time that these new statistics keep piling up, that we are on a planet that is changing radically, and when something like an oil disaster in the Gulf occurs, it is tragic to the humans who died. It is tragic to the marine life that have also died. And it is tragic for the future, because we still don't know how long the implications of this much damage in the corals will have. It is another one of those huge experiments. Nothing like this has been seen exactly before, and we don't precisely know what the consequences are going to be this year, next year, 5 years from now, or 10 years from now.
And you know, Linda, it's bad enough that the sea life itself is being depleted because of mankind grabbing as much fish as they can. Now we have these problems to face.
And that so much marine life is dependent on the corals. You can't have the oceans be the way they have been for millennia without the coral. And yet the coral are taking it in the ear all over the world in both hemispheres. And this is going to be a story to watch in the next 6 months. What happens in the Great Barrier Reef off of Australia? If they start seeing increasing coral death there, then we know that we're on a planet that is beginning to turn what we have known as the living habitats for marine life upside down. And what humans can do about this? What can humans do to change something that is argued about global warming? I think it's fair to say that everyone agrees there is a general trend toward global warming, regardless of the cause. The consequences may be much bigger than we have ever anticipated.
Up next, Linda talks about concrete ICBM heavy silo covers being moved aside by glowing disks. That's next on Coast to Coast AM.